Well, everybody, it is great to see you, whether you're here in the room or joining us online. Really honored to have you along for the ride. As many of you know, we're in the second week of a series that we've called Moving the Needle. The series is all about helping to make this world a little more like God wants it to be, like helping his kingdom to come and his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven, while at the same time finding a better life for yourself. So you help the world, you help yourself, and I know that sounds like it's a bit too good to be true, but I'm convinced it really is true. And in this series, for 4 weeks, I'm showing you why. And basically what we're doing is we're exploring the invitation that Jesus gives to his followers, both in ancient times and today, to leverage, and around here we call it this, to leverage their time, their talent, and their resources to sort of move the needle in the right direction for all sorts of things that really need to be better in our world, while at the same time moving the needle on all sorts of things that need to be better in their lives. It's a real win-win proposition. And that's why as this stuff has been sort of marinating and percolating in my soul, I'm like, I cannot wait to unleash it upon y'all, okay? So anyway, that said, to get us going today, I want to tell you about a conversation that I had many moons ago while leading a group of high school students on a mission trip to Juarez, Mexico. And I brought a picture. This is Juarez. It's not exactly Cancun. If you are familiar, if like I've been to Mexico, you've been to Mexico-ish, okay? Juarez is like Mexico, Mexico. It sits just across the border from El Paso, Texas. And so as you might imagine, I mean, just the Rio Grande River is the border, but the cities are geographically adjacent, but economically speaking, they're worlds apart. Anyway, after dinner on the last day of our trip, we hiked to the top of a mountain. Mountain is probably ambitious, maybe more like a large hill, right? So that we could kind of look down on the city as the sun was setting and talk about what we had experienced. And so we'd spent the better part of a week serving alongside people, fantastic people, from a Mexican church who were hosting a summer camp for some of the poorest kids in their city. So, and honestly, these were some of the poorest kids I had ever met. We played and we laughed and we threw water balloons at each other and we shared meals and we had lots of intentional conversations with the other church people about God and Jesus and faith and life and why they chose to do what they did in their community. And so at the end of our time in Mexico, I was really excited as a youth pastor to hear what the students were taking away from the trip. I mean, you take kids from Ada and Cascade and you put them in Juarez and anything can happen, right? Some of it good. Anyway, as the sun was setting that day, a student asked me a question that honestly I've never forgotten. And here's what he said. Why do I find myself so envious of the faith of the Mexican Christians? And I said, what do you mean? And he's like, well, it's almost like somehow in spite of their material poverty, I mean, relative to us, you know, they have a spiritual richness that he says, I really crave. And then he looked at me and he said, you know what I mean? And without hesitation, I said, absolutely, that's why we're here. And then I told him something that actually surprised him. I said, you know, material wealth has always had some unintended and undesirable side effects when it comes to faith. In fact, I said, there are actually verses in the Bible that warn wealthy people to be careful because, as it turns out, wealth, which is certainly a good thing, can also be a real challenge for faith. And then I gave him an example. It's a famous example. It's from a letter written 2,000 years ago by a veteran pastor named Paul. And he was writing to his protege, his Padawan, his learner, disciple guy, a man named Timothy, who at the time was a pastor in the city of Ephesus. It was a major urban center. And I think it's worth noting before I show you what Paul said to Timothy, just to note that Paul would have known people within the church in Ephesus personally because before he wrote the letter to their pastor, he had lived with them for 3 years. He knew them, many of them, by name. And so he knew their world, he knew their challenges, he knew how they experienced life. And so in this letter, Paul encouraged Timothy to encourage the wealthy people in his congregation. And he began with these words. Here's what Paul wrote. He says, command, and the Greek word is a little softer than this. It's more like instruct, but command those who are rich in this present world. And just before I show you what he says next, just he's like, Paul says, Timothy, you're going to have to teach the people who have resources in your community to do something that they're not naturally going to do on their own. You're going to have to help them because, as I just said, material wealth carries with it some unique side effects when it comes to faith. And so now, before I show you what Paul says next, I can't help myself. I want to share a couple of fascinating things that I discovered about wealth when I was doing some research for this series. Beginning with the observation made by multiple sociologists that wealthy people tend to be unable to recognize the fact that they're wealthy. Isn't that fun? In other words, they live with a sense of denial. And here's what I mean. If you were to interview some rich people, you would often find that they just don't see themselves as rich. And if you think about it, that is really unique. Because there's other things that we have no trouble acknowledging. For example, tall people like me readily admit that we're tall. There was a girl at the Pokey place right by the church here, and I stood up, and she was like 4 years old, and she was like, whoa. That's all she said, whoa. And her mom said, yes, he is tall. And I said, yes, I am tall. No problem admitting that I'm tall. Short people in my life, right, they tend to admit that they're short. And introverts, they don't mind, telling you that they're introverts. And extroverts can't wait to tell you that they're extroverts. And athletic people can admit they're athletic. And artsy people don't mind telling you that they're artsy. And we can tell anyway because, like, their rooms and their cars and their lives are a hot mess, right? And they're just as happy about it as they can be, right? Yeah, we all have a few in our lives like that. Anyway, people will generally acknowledge a whole bunch of things that are true of them. But see, when it comes to being rich, people seem to live in denial. And again, this is what these sociologists have discovered. In fact, there's a poll by the Gallup organization that they did not too long ago. And they asked people to define what it means to be rich. And what they learned was absolutely fascinating. Because almost nobody who responded to their survey thought that they were rich. And so the researchers concluded that apparently rich is a matter of perspective. They found that people that made $75,000 a year said that people who made $150,000 a year were clearly rich. And they said that people who made $150,000 a year said that people who made $300,000 a year were rich. And I just thought that was rich. Sorry, but years ago, Money Magazine did something similar. They asked people how much they would need to have saved in order to feel rich. And the average answer, and this has not been since the pandemic, so it's higher now, but the average answer was $5 million, which means that somewhere there are people who have $4 million that are like, not rich, right? And also, there are other people who are thinking right now, maybe if you're worth $5 million, like, I don't feel rich either, right? So my point is this. My point is that nobody's rich, but everybody knows somebody who is, right? In other words, it must be that for each of us, somewhere out there, there's a magic number that when someone crosses it, they're rich. But even when they cross it, they're probably not aware that they crossed it and that they're rich. So I guess it's fair to say that one of the unexpected and challenging side effects of wealth is denial. See, but that's not all I found when I was preparing for today, because I also discovered that according to people who study this sort of thing, and I don't know who goes into this as a field of study, but they're out there, right? A second unexpected side effect of wealth seems to be, and this is fascinating, discontentment. Wealthy people tend to be more discontent. And when they dug down and thought about why, they said, well, it really seems like the accumulation of stuff is a little bit like an appetite that can never be fully satisfied. In other words, like when it comes to stuff, it only seems like we desire more the more we have. And so not coincidentally, these researchers also acknowledge that this tends to be a bigger problem for rich people than poor people for a very simple reason. And you should write this down. This is profound, worth the price of admission today, which is free. Rich people tend to buy more stuff than poor people. Thank you. Right. Yeah. They really do. But you see, when they get this more stuff, their appetite for stuff doesn't shrink. It grows. And so consequently, the more a person has, on average, the more they tend to want. And that's why, and you know this, it's impossible to purchase your way to contentment. And if that surprises you, I think I know why. And especially if you're younger and you haven't quite figured this out yet, because we do all get there eventually. But if that surprises you, I think I know why. And it has to do with the fact that years ago, wonderful people in the marketing industry in our country figured out that it was going to be entirely possible for a large percentage of the American population to accumulate everything that we truly need in order to live. And that reality would be a real challenge for an economy based on consumption. And so in response, these wonderful marketing people invented something to ensure that no one ever would feel content. And they called it, are you ready? The upgrade, right? And here's how it works. Through strategic and repeated marketing, you convince people that even though they have a particular something that works perfectly fine, they need a new one, right? For example, you convince people to drive their cars that work into a car lot, fully planning to leave them there and to drive away with another car that also works, right? Or you convince people to walk into a perfectly good kitchen. You would do this through, I don't know, a whole network of television shows that does the same thing every episode. Are you familiar with this? I love that, but yeah. People walk into a perfectly good kitchen. You know, it has all the things, countertops, a refrigerator, microwave, and an oven, and they dream of ripping it all out in order to replace it with a new countertops, a refrigerator, or a microwave, and an oven. Or through marketing, you convince people that as they stand in front of a closet that they cannot literally put another piece of clothing in, that they don't have anything to wear. Don't nudge the person next to you. It's awkward. Yeah. Even though they have work clothes and workout clothes and after work clothes and yard work clothes and even painting t-shirts. Let's be honest, how many painting t-shirts does any of us need, right? And you're like, when was the last time you painted? You're like, but I might someday. It might just hit a fit of inspiration. Anyway, I'm telling you, in much of the world, experiences like these are unthinkable. But in our world, they're normal. Because as we've said, wealth seems to have potential side effects, including denial and discontentment. Okay, that said, back to Paul. So he writes this letter to his protege, Timothy, and as he continues to encourage Timothy as to how to encourage the wealthy people, he identified what I would argue is the most sinister side effect to wealth. The others are just more interesting than anything, but this one's sinister, and I like to call this one hope migration. And so Paul began to describe hope migration this way. Here's what he wrote. He says, command those who are rich in the present world, we talked about that already, not to be arrogant, nor, look at this, to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain. In other words, Paul wrote, like, okay, wealth naturally leaves people with the impression that they're self-sufficient and don't really need God, even though they really do need God. That's what I mean when I say that wealth inadvertently initiates hope migration. As wealth increases, hope naturally migrates from God to wealth. And as it turns out, it's been that way pretty much for as long as there have been people. In fact, 1,000 years before the time of Jesus, the author of an Old Testament book called Proverbs, which is a collection of ancient wisdom, and the author, by the way, was far richer and wiser than most of us will ever be, he described the challenge of wealth this way. And again, he's speaking from his own experience. He wrote, "The wealth of the rich is their fortified city. They imagine it as a wall too high to scale." Isn't that interesting? So like 3,000 years ago, this wealthy author of Proverbs wrote that wealth lends people to imagine that they can protect themselves from like every eventuality in life. And he says they imagine it's a wall too high to scale because in the end, there's no amount of money that can protect us from every eventuality. I mean, it's natural to think that if you achieve a certain amount of wealth, you'll be secure, that you'll be able to protect yourself and your family and your kids and your grandkids. That it's like a human tendency to think that we can sort of save our way to safety. But see, here's the thing. If we really believe this, if we really believe we can save our way to safety, then our hope migrates from where it should be to our ability to leverage our wealth to control outcomes. And to be clear, wealth can control some outcomes. It just can't control the outcomes that are most important. So we try to control the outcomes, but the thing is, this is a dangerous proposition because if think about this. How much money would you need in order to secure your future against all imaginable eventualities? How much money so that you could live totally without fear and be totally confident that nothing could ever touch you or those you love? And obviously, it's a rhetorical question because we all know the answer. The answer is, how much money do I need to do that? More than I currently have, right? Regardless of how much I currently have. In fact, there's a guy named J.D. Rockefeller who's generally believed to be the richest man in modern history. Elon Musk, right on his tail. But right now, I checked this week, okay? But he reportedly was asked how much money was enough, right? To feel secure, to feel like you've arrived, to feel like you've made it. How much, richest guy ever, do you need? His response, $1 more. And he was smiling when he said it, right? There's no amount of wealth that will make us feel as if we have arrived. And that's why it's so troubling, because when hope migrates to wealth, it's like if your hope is in your wealth and your hope has migrated to wealth, then you have to look to your wealth to protect you. You have to prioritize the building of this proverbial wall of protection. And that's why, and this is so interesting, studies have even shown that relatively wealthy people tend to give away less of a percentage of their income than do poor people. And you say, well, why is that? Well, it's because relatively poor people aren't trying to save their way to safety. Like, they can't live with the myth that their minimum wage job is going to keep them safe. But see, it's natural for a relatively wealthy person to imagine that we can build an unscalable wall of protection. It's natural even for people who don't consider themselves to be rich. The human heart migrates without us trying. And that's why Paul wants Timothy to help the Ephesian Christians to put their hope in the only place that can truly hold their hope, to put their hope back where it belongs. And he said it this way. He wrote, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God. And I'm telling you this whole hope migration thing away from God and towards wealth is such a big deal that Jesus talked about it all the time. And Jesus talked about it all the time to anyone who would listen because he understood wealth to be nothing less than the chief competitor for our hearts, because it's the chief competitor for our hopes. So it's like one day, Jesus gathers a group of his followers and he's trying to encourage them along this front. And this is what he said that day. He said, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and vermin destroy. And I don't know, if you grew up in the 80s like me, you're like, isn't it moth and rust? That's what I memorized. No, it turns out it's vermin. What do you know? All right? So do not store for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But, he says, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. And then he drops this, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. In other words, Jesus acknowledged the reality that when hope begins to migrate, wealth unintentionally becomes a substitute for God in our lives. And again, none of us like make that decision. It just happens. We're broken people in a broken world. It just happens. And check out what Jesus says next now. He says, no one can serve two masters. For you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. He says, you cannot serve both God and money. That is the tension. And that's the challenge of navigating life in this world when it comes to wealth. And again, it's true today. It's true 2,000 years ago. And it was true 3,000 years ago, around the time that rich, wise person wrote the book that we call Proverbs. And in fact, check out this prayer that he recorded again 3,000 years ago. He asked God, and I love this. He says, God, give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. You see the whole back, throwing back to the manna there in the wilderness. Give me only what I need for today. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? In other words, The author of Proverbs wrote, God, give me only what I need, or I'll forget that in the end, I really only need you. Because you love me, you care for me, and you will provide for me. See, the author of Proverbs understood all too well that wealth can become a wedge that can separate us from God. In fact, wealth can become a substitute for God. Okay, so now I was trying to think, how do we land this, you know, thought today? And so I came up with kind of an interesting application for you, just something to think about this week. And what I want to do is I'm going to show you two statements, one and then the other. And just be honest with yourself, and the exercise works a lot better, okay? And no one will know, just kind of in the quiet of your own heart. So I'm going to show you two statements, and I want you to ask yourself the question, which of these two statements elicits a greater sense of fear or anxiety in my heart? Like right now, snapshot today. So here's the first one. What if, okay, this idea, there is no God. In other words, imagine that when you die, it's lights out, it's over, you'll never see your loved ones again, they'll never see you again, it's as if you never existed. There's no purpose, there's nothing beyond this life. So that's the first, you know, depressing statement. So there you go, right? So just pay attention to how it makes you feel in comparison to the next one. You have no money. In other words, like what if, like right now, all of your financial resources evaporated, all of it, and you can't get it back? You're like at zero. So which of these two statements, as you sit here today, created more anxiety in you? And again, no judgment. And while you're thinking about that, let me tweak the context just a little bit. Instead of just as you sit here this morning, imagine that you're in the hospital and you've just been told that you don't have long to live. Now which statement causes you more anxiety? And I'm sure it's the idea that there's no God, because in the end, the money thing, it doesn't matter at the end of a life. And I suspect that this is true of you, whether you grew up as an atheist or you grew up in church and never missed a Sunday. It makes no difference in the end. In the last moments of our lives, 100% of our hope is going to be in God. And so here's my question and Paul's point in his letter to Timothy and what Jesus said over and over and over and over again, because he loves us and he wants to show us a better way. He said, if your hope is going to be in God at the end of your life, why not put your hope in him now? And it's interesting because as Paul lands this thought to Timothy, he says something that might surprise you. Check out what he says. So, command those who are rich in the present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain. We talked about that. But to put their hope in God. And then look at this. Who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. And you're like, I thought Paul was telling wealthy, he was like, scold those wealthy people because their hope migrated. No. Put your hope in God because he's the one who richly provides you with everything for your enjoyment. I wonder, does that surprise you? Does it surprise you to learn that God actually wants people to enjoy their stuff? And I wonder, is that a different vision of God than you had when you were growing up? I mean, if you think about it, the implications to this are staggering. It means that from God's perspective, you can buy new clothes and upgrade your kitchen and trade in your car. So if you felt judged earlier, you know, there you go, right? But don't make the mistake of putting your hope in your wealth. So this isn't about stuff, it's about hope. Because if you put your hope in your wealth, it will eventually let you down. Your wealth can't hold the weight of your expectations. So it's almost like Paul's asking these wealthy Christians in Ephesus, why would you put your hope in the provision when you can put your hope in the provider? Like, why would you spend your life building a security wall that doesn't in the end leave you secure? Like, it's a wall, but it's a mirage. Why would you put your hope in riches when things like the stock market can fall apart? Why would you put your hope in riches when you might one day get too sick to enjoy them? I mean, in the end, if riches don't matter, why would you put your hope in them now. Why would you not put your hope in the one who richly provides? And I just want to ask you one more question, and then we'll wrap it up for today. But as you sit here, if you're being honest with yourself, and this is a great question to ask yourself repeatedly because this is not a one-and-done decision. Has your hope migrated? And maybe your hope has migrated because you've been through a stretch where life has happened. It's happened to you. It's happened to someone you love. And you just kind of feel like, I don't know. I feel like God let me down, right? And maybe someday I'll look back and see that he hadn't let me down. But right now it kind of feels like he let me down. And if that's the stretch you're in and you wandered in here today, I'm telling you, it is so natural for you to try to control the uncontrollable. And so I get it, but it's still a bad idea. God's like, I love you. Will you trust me? I've got you. Will you trust me? Whatever you're going through, it's going to be okay. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be okay. Will you trust me? Keep your hope where it belongs because I'm the only one who can really hold the weight of your hope. So has your hope migrated? And again, maybe it happened without you realizing it, and maybe it happened because of a life situation that you weren't planning on and it's impossible. Has your hope migrated? Like, even though you may not think of yourself as rich, have you put your hope in your ability to leverage your wealth, to control the outcomes, to save your way to safety? And if that's the case, I would ask you to shift it back to where it belongs. Because if you allow your hope to migrate to your wealth, it can be dangerous to your faith. It can lead you to believe that everything you have is designated for your consumption. Shuts down generosity completely or mostly, and it can lead you to try and build an unscalable wall that really can't keep you safe. I mean, and by the way, it's kind of a PS, but most of you already caught this, but this is why a teenager from Ada, Michigan, on a missions trip to Juarez, Mexico, articulates that he envies the faith of the Mexican Christians. That's why sometimes when we take ourselves or students, we got a group in Uganda right now, and I guarantee you a few of them are having that thought, when they sit with these girls that have nothing, and yet the faith that they have is so alive. It's like we go to bless them, and we end up getting blessed. But this is why a teenager from Ada, Michigan goes to Juarez, Mexico, to say that he envies the faith of those Mexican Christians. See, in our culture, it is so natural for hope to migrate. It's so natural. But see, according to Jesus, there's a better way, and it's better for you. And it's better for the world. It's a win-win. According to Jesus, life is better when you put your hope not in your riches, but in the one who richly provides. And this is super cool. I'm going to telegraph forward to next week, so get excited. Here we go. As Paul continues, he actually gives us a powerful practical tool that can keep our hope from migrating. And you're like, I can't wait to hear what that is. Tell me what that is. You have to come back next week because we're out of time, okay? But it's been working for thousands of years. So anyway, if you're here in the room now, please stand and I'll close our time together in prayer. Heavenly Father, you are so, so good. And you are so good even in our rebellion, whether it is on purpose or accidental. And thank you for preserving this ancient wisdom of your son and of the first few who followed him, just to point us to the fact that there is only one place where our hope belongs, and it is in you. And so I pray that this week we would take an honest look at our hearts, and we would maybe confess to you if our hope has migrated, and that we might affirm our commitment to look to you first and to receive the blessings of this life as blessings from you. I pray that in that we may find the contentment that is so elusive in our culture. But thank you for loving us. Thank you for believing in us, even when we don't believe in ourselves. And thank you for meeting us at our worst and inviting us forward. But for today, I just pray a blessing of your grace and your peace on us all. In the matchless name of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ, we pray. And everyone said, amen. Before you leave, if you'd like to pray with someone or talk with someone, we have some friends that'll be under the screen to the left. Otherwise, we'll see you next week.